If you've been attending the 11 o'clock service this fall, you know that I'm in the middle of a sermon series on Joseph. So it seems kind of funny, but I'm going to be continuing a sermon series that's already started at our first service here today. So I hope that's okay. And hopefully, if you haven't been part of that sermon series, you're at least familiar enough with the story of Joseph to catch up with us and pick up where we are today. We're almost at the really highest point of the story. We're closing in on it. And just to kind of bring you up to speed, because it's been a couple weeks since we've talked about Joseph. Joseph and his sons, Jacob and his sons have run out of food for the second time, because there's a huge famine going on throughout all of the land. So Jacob gives orders to his sons to go to Egypt for a second time to get more food. And when he does that, they remind him, they said, "Dad, when we came home from our first trip to Egypt, we told you that the guy who's in charge of food in Egypt said, don't come back here, don't let me see your face again unless you bring your youngest brother. And so if you want us to go back to Egypt, we have to take Benjamin. Otherwise, there's no point in going." And Jacob said, "Absolutely not. Over my dead body, you will not take my youngest son. No how, no way." And so they argued. Jacob refusing to let, at this point, his most treasured possession on earth leave for sake that he would lose now Benjamin as well. And the brothers saying, "Look, Dad, if we take Benjamin, there's the risk that we lose him. But if we don't take him and we stay here, we all die. So you have two bad choices, but at least make the better of two bad choices. Otherwise, we all die if we stay here without food." And so different of the older brothers try to bargain with their dad. Reuben really makes an unbelievable bargain with Jacob. He says, "Look, Dad, if we take Benjamin down there and we lose him, you can kill two of my sons. You can kill two of your grandsons." And Jacob refuses that one. And then later, Judah comes to him and says, "Dad, look, let us take Benjamin. I will take full responsibility for him. If something happens to him, then I will be guilty in front of you for the rest of my life. His life will be on me," basically is what he says. So finally, Jacob relents and he says, "Okay, well, look, take Benjamin. I know he's not coming back. Basically, my life is over, but what choice do I have?" And so the brothers take Benjamin and they head to Egypt. And upon their arrival in Egypt, they're immediately taken to Joseph's palace, unknown to them. It's Joseph, of course. And they're just fear-struck because they don't want to go to this emperor's palace. They just want to get food and go back home. But nevertheless, they're taken to Joseph's palace, and they're scared to death, and they're brought into a banquet hall. And they sit around this banquet hall where they're served. And if you recall, a couple weeks ago, I mentioned that Joseph did not eat with his brothers because the Egyptians did not eat with foreigners. So Joseph is seated in one place. The brothers are seated at another place. But the most shocking thing for the brothers is that when they came in and when they began to take their places around the banquet table, they found that their assigned seating was in order of their birth order, from oldest to youngest. Obviously, Joseph knew the birth order. But these brothers didn't know it was Joseph, and so they are absolutely flabbergasted that here they are, the stranger puts them in birth order. You know, just the world is spinning for them. Things don't make sense. And then, when they sit down to eat, they find that Benjamin receives five times as much food as the other brothers. And this is all part of Joseph's test to find out, how do they treat the youngest brother who gets treated with favoritism? Have these guys changed? Well, they finish the meal. And that's where we pick up the story today, because now the brothers are ready to get their food and go back to Canaan, go back home. And so we read in Genesis 44, verses 1, 2, it says, "Now Joseph gave these instructions to the steward of his house. Fill the men's sacks with as much food as they can carry, and put each man's silver in the mouth of his sack. And then put my cup, the silver one, in the mouth of the youngest one's sack, along with the silver for his grain." And he did as Joseph said. Joseph is not done testing his brothers. He has another big test for them, and the test involves putting his personal silver cup or silver goblet in the sack that belongs to Benjamin, unawares to Benjamin and other unawares to all the brothers. So this silver cup or silver goblet is secretly placed in the top of Benjamin's sack. Now, I want to stop here and point something out that you probably never noticed just by a superficial reading of the text. And that is that in chapters 42 through 45 of Genesis, the word silver is mentioned 20 different times. The word silver is mentioned 20 different times. It just so happens that Joseph's brothers sold him for 20 pieces of silver. Now, is that a coincidence? I don't think so. The text is making a point. Joseph was sold for 20 pieces of silver, and now silver plays a role in these brothers' enslavement. There's just like this seamless web that runs through the story, and I've mentioned it over and over, and we're still going to see it again. What comes around goes around. What you do to others comes back on you. And that's the point that's being made here. And so silver is being used to force these brothers to confront again, to confront once again what they did to Joseph. All right, verse 3. "As morning dawned, the men were sent on their way with their donkeys. They had not gone far from the city when Joseph said to his steward, 'Go after those men at once, and when you catch up with them, say to them, why have you repaid good with evil? Isn't this the cup my master drinks from and also uses for divination? This is a wicked thing that you have done.'" So the brothers are now in this setup. They are now being blamed for stealing Joseph's silver cup. Now, this is not just any silver cup. Okay, not only does Joseph use this for drinking, but he also uses it for divination. Divination is the pagan practice of basically foretelling the future. And we don't know exactly how Joseph does this, but somehow he uses this silver cup, this silver goblet, and probably using liquid that goes into the goblet, somehow he's able to use that to foretell the future. Now, it's important to note that divination, this practice of foretelling the future, was strictly outlawed later on in the Old Testament. When you get to the books of Leviticus and Deuteronomy, it's strictly prohibited. For example, in Leviticus 19:26, it says, "Do not practice divination or sorcery," because these were the practices of the surrounding pagan cultures. And so later this will be outlawed, but at this point in the story, this is something that Joseph does. And we don't know if it's simply because it's part of his role as the second in command over all of Egypt. We don't know if it's because maybe he was able to interpret dreams, and so it was assumed that because he could interpret dreams, that therefore he could foretell the future in other areas. We don't know, but somehow this silver goblet was part of this divination practice. So for the brothers to steal this silver goblet was a big deal, not just for the material value of it, but for what it represented in regards to Joseph. So we go on to verses 6 and 7. It says, "When he caught up with them, he repeated these words to them. But they said to him, 'Why does my Lord say such things? Far be it from your servants to do anything like that.'" You know, here's these poor brothers, and once again, they're being blamed, they're being condemned for something they haven't done. You know, they're constantly being tricked. They're constantly having things done to them. And now they're being blamed for taking the almost Pharaoh taking his silver cup. And they can't believe it, and they protest precisely because they didn't take it. And they put up actually a very good argument in verse 8. They say, "We even brought back to you from the land of Canaan the silver we found inside the mouths of our sacks. So why would we steal silver or gold from your master's house?" On their last trip down to Egypt, Joseph had tricked them again by putting all the silver that they had used to pay for their food, putting it back in the mouths of their sacks. Well, they had brought that silver back to Egypt on their second trip, and they're saying, "Look, if we returned all that silver the first time, why would we then now just steal a simple silver cup? That silver from before was worth a lot more. Now, why would we go into your house and just steal a silver cup? We if we were going to do that, we would stay with what was most valuable, not with a cup." And it's a very good argument. And in fact, they're so confident of their innocence that they say in verse 9, "If any of your servants is found to have it, he will die, and the rest of us will become my Lord's slaves." These brothers are so confident of their innocence, they know they're not guilty of this, that they literally bet their lives on it. "Look, if we have it, whoever has it in his sack, he'll die and the rest of us will become slaves. Look, it's just an easy bet. We know we didn't take it." Well, in verse 10, the steward says, "Very well then, let it be as you say. Whoever is found to have it will become my slave, and the rest of you will be free from blame." So the steward accepts part of the brother's bargain. He accepts the part that if they're guilty, they will become slaves. But he doesn't accept the part about whoever has the silver will be killed. He just says, "All of you will become slaves." And probably because the steward is in on Joseph's trick here. He's in on Joseph's game. He's been coached by Joseph what to say. And the point is that Joseph is trying to set up a scenario which will isolate Benjamin in such a position where Benjamin will be at the point of having to become a slave, and then the brothers will have to make a decision. Will we stand up for our younger brother, or will we allow him to become a slave? He's trying to set up, as close as he can, the exact scenario which he himself, Joseph, was under with his brothers. "These brothers sold me into slavery. They abandoned me. They let me go. Now what will they do with their other younger brother, Benjamin? Will they abandon him the same way that they abandoned me, or have they become better men?" So verse 11 says, "Each of them quickly lowered his sack to the ground and opened it. And then the steward proceeded to search, beginning with the oldest and ending with the youngest. And the cup was found in Benjamin's sack." Unbelievable. I mean, can you imagine how the brothers felt at this point? I mean, they had to be absolutely beside themselves. How is this possible? Just, it's like the world is out of control. Everything is just completely stacked against them. They didn't take anything. They are absolutely as innocent as can be. All they want to do is get their food and get home, and just nothing is that simple. Every time they go on a trip, something happens. One of them's getting blamed. One of them's being taken into captivity. They always look like the bad guys, but the truth is they're completely innocent, at least of the things that they're being accused of right now. And now the worst of all scenarios is being played out. Benjamin is now guilty of a crime which will cause him to become a slave in Egypt for the rest of his life. How are they supposed to go home and break the news to their father? They know it will literally kill him. And they're innocent. Well, verse 13 says, "At this, they tore their clothes." Okay, the tearing of the clothes is a sign of mourning. Interestingly enough, this is exactly what Jacob did when he found out that Joseph was gone. He tore his clothes. And so now, at the idea that Benjamin will take, and now the brothers are tearing their clothes. They're basically saying, we give up. There's nothing we can do. It's just a statement of utter sadness and depression and just basically just giving in. So verse 14, they go back to the house, and Joseph was still in the house when Judah and his brothers came in, and they threw themselves to the ground before him. Joseph said to them, what is this that you have done? Don't you know that a man like me can find things out by divination? It's a very interesting statement by Joseph here. Basically saying, are you guys stupid? Do you think I wouldn't know? In a way, he's almost saying, don't you know that I have these kind of magical powers that I can just figure this stuff out? You think you can pull this over on me? And they're caught. What are they supposed to say? The cup is in Benjamin's sack. What are they supposed to say? So Judah begins to speak. He says, what can we say to my Lord? What can we say? How can we prove our innocence? This is a very normal and human reaction to this situation. You know, what are we supposed to say? We're caught red-handed. The cup was in Benjamin's sack. There's no defense I can give. I mean, everything is pointing to our guilt. What can I do, he says. And then Judah says something interesting. He says, God has uncovered your servant's guilt. Talking about himself. Now, what guilt is Judah talking about here? God has uncovered your servant's guilt. Was he talking about stealing the silver cup? No, because Judah did not steal the silver cup and neither did Benjamin. So there'd be no reason for him to feel guilty about that. What he is feeling guilty for is the crime that got this whole thing started in the first place. And now, at least in front of Joseph, for the very first time, Judah is acknowledging that what they did was wrong, and they're paying the consequences for it now. That attempting to kill their younger brother Joseph is really what lies at the root of all this craziness that's going on. And amazingly, unbeknownst to them, they are now confessing this to Joseph, the man that they had wronged. And then Judah continues. He says, we are now my Lord's slaves. We ourselves and the one who was found to have the cup. So basically at this point, they're saying, we give up. We know what the penalty is. We know what the crime is. We know what the punishment is. So, you know, go ahead and do it. We're all your slaves. Verse 17, but Joseph says, far be it from me to do such a thing. Only the man who was found to have the cup will become my slave. The rest of you, go back to your father in peace. Now at this point, Joseph is giving the brothers the opportunity to leave. You guys don't have to be my slaves, he says. Only Benjamin, only the one who's truly guilty, he has to be my slaves. Why? Because Joseph is trying to put these brothers in a situation where they, if they want to, can abandon their younger brother once again. Because that's all what this is about. Will they do what they did to me given the opportunity? And he's given them the opportunity. He says, go, you guys get out of here. Go in peace. Go back to your father. After all, Benjamin's going to be a slave either way. So why should they stick around? So go ahead and go. They can cut and run if they want to. Now what comes next is one of the most elegant pleas in all of literature. If many different commentators from many different backgrounds agree that this is one of the most elegant statements of a request or a plea for mercy that exists in all of literature. And it's Judah who does the speaking here. And basically there are two themes that Judah's going to use in his plea for mercy from Joseph. And the first one is, he says, we are your servants. He's going to say that over and over. He uses the word servant 13 different times in his plea. Basically, he's just completely humbling himself. He's making it clear that he is completely at Joseph's mercy. He's not arguing with Joseph. He's just begging for mercy. And he says, I am your slave. You can do to me whatever you want. I am your slave. And the second theme he will use is basically, please feel pity on my father. please feel pity on my father. He uses the word father 14 times in this plea. And it's always a reference to Jacob. So he says, basically, we are your servants. We are at your mercy. And please feel pity for my father. And so he begins. Verse 18, then Judah went up to him and said, please, my lord, let your servant speak a word to my lord. Do not be angry with your servant. See, he is the servant here. Though you are equal to Pharaoh himself. In other words, you know, that you are so far above me that this is not an equal communication that we're having. You're so far above me. You're Pharaoh and I'm a servant, he says. My lord asks his servants, and now he's reminding Joseph what happened the first time they were in Egypt. Joseph asked his servants, do you have a father or a brother? And we answered, we have an aged father, and there is a young son born to him in his old age. His brother is dead, and he is the only one of his mother's sons left, and his father loves him. Basically, Judah is saying, look, the impact that this is going to have on my father is just huge. And he knows because he can remember the impact it had on Jacob when Joseph was taken. And now he knows the effect it'll have if Benjamin is taken. And Judah makes it clear that their father especially loves Benjamin more than all the other brothers. But he doesn't say it out of anger, out of resentment. He says it out of pity for his father. He says, look, our father loves this boy more than the rest of us. He's the prized possession and we're not. But for that reason, please have pity on my father. And he goes on, then you said to your servants, and again, he's reminding them of prior conversations, bring him down to me so I can see him for myself. And we said to my lord, the boy cannot leave his father. If he leaves him, his father will die. But you told your servants, unless your youngest brother comes down with you, you will not see my face again. When we went back to your servant, my father, we told him what my lord had said. And then our father said, go back and buy a little more food. But we said, we cannot go down. Only if our youngest brother is with us will we go. We cannot see the man's face unless our youngest brother is with us. Your servant, my father, said to us, you know that my wife bore me two sons. One of them went away from me, and I said, he has surely been torn to pieces, and I have not seen him since. If you take this one from me too, and harm comes to him, you will bring my gray head down to the grave in misery. So first of all, Judah explains the effect that this will have on his dad. He tells the story about the two sons and how one of them is already gone, and now he can't bear to lose the other one. And you have to wonder, what impact did this have on Joseph hearing this? Perhaps for the first time, Joseph is seeing what it was like to be in the family through his older brother's eyes. Maybe Joseph had never appreciated the level of favoritism that existed in the family and the impact that it had on the older brothers. And maybe he's thinking, oh my goodness, I didn't know how bad it was in that family. I didn't realize how tough it was to be in a family where our father so favored me and my brother above the rest. And how much he loved our mother more than the other boys' mothers. I didn't know what it was like. Maybe he's thinking that for the first time. And also, Joseph learns what his family thinks actually happened to him. Joseph never knew what his family actually thought happened to him. But in verse 28, it says, one of them went away from me, and I said, he has surely been torn to pieces, and I have not seen him since. Now Joseph knows what his father thinks his demise was, that he was eaten by an animal. Now he knows what the father believed about what happened to him. And now the punchline of Judah's request. He says, so now, if the boy is not with us, when I go back to your servant, my father, and if my father, whose life is closely bound up with the boy's life, sees that the boy isn't there, he will die. Your servants will bring the gray head of our father down to the grave in sorrow. Your servant guaranteed the boy's safety to my father. I said, if I do not bring him back to you, I will bear the blame before you, my father, all my life. Now then, please let your servant remain here as my Lord's slave in place of the boy, and let the boy return with his brothers. How can I go back to my father if the boy is not with me? No, do not let me see the misery that would come upon my father. That is a powerful plea that he makes on behalf of Benjamin, and really on behalf of himself and on behalf of his father. Basically, Judah just pours out his heart and his soul to this Egyptian official. He says, here's what's at stake for my father and for me, and basically everything is riding on you allowing our youngest brother to go back home. And at this point, you have to wonder, is there any doubt remaining in Joseph's mind that his brothers are different? Or at least that Judah is different? Is there any doubt? And once again, we see this theme of what comes around goes around. Because what did Judah offer himself to be? A slave. He says, look, I'll be the slave. And now look at Genesis 37, 26 and 27. This is going back to when Joseph was given away by his brothers. The brothers are having lunch and Joseph is in the pit. And Judah said to his brothers, what will we gain if we kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites. The brother who advocated selling Joseph as a slave is now the one who offers himself to Joseph as a slave. There's just this web that goes throughout this story. The one who says, let's sell him as a slave, now says, I will be your slave, basically. Now, has Judah changed? Is he a different man? This man who earlier took virtually no responsibility for his younger brother, the one who said, look, let's sell him into slavery. Now Judah is the one who says, look, I take full responsibility for my younger brother. Yeah, I could run away right now. I could go free and leave him here, but I'm not going to. In fact, he goes to the point where he's willing to give his life for his younger brother. And the circumstances are pretty similar between Benjamin's situation and what Joseph's situation was when his brother sold him into slavery. Benjamin is the favorite son, just like Joseph was. The brothers had every reason to resent Benjamin, just like they did Joseph. The favoritism is still there. But the difference is that now Judah is a grown man. He's matured. He's taken responsibility. And he realizes that being a brother means that you ask more than just, do I like him? If the only question about being a brother was, do I like him? Then he was completely justified in getting rid of Joseph. But now Judah is asking a much bigger question. He's saying, regardless of how I feel about Benjamin and regardless of how our father treats us differently, I am his brother and I take responsibility for him. He's my brother and I take responsibility for him. And it really points forward to Jesus, who came along and said, well, he asked the question, who is your neighbor? And he says, your neighbor is not just the person who you like. Your neighbor can even be the person who you don't like. And so when it comes to how we treat people, the question is not, do you like the person or not? The question is, do you take responsibility for your neighbor? That's what it means to grow up. You know, that's why family life is so important. It's so shaping. You know, when you grow up with siblings, what do siblings do? They fight all the time. But it's also the place where we first learn how to work out our differences with people. People who in many ways we can't stand. You know, my boys right now, they fight at least as much as they play together nicely. And so it's all about selfishness at this age. But it's in this process of having to interact with each other that they figure out that there's more to life than just me, that I'm not the center of the universe. And whether I like my brother or not, that there's times that I have to take responsibility for him. And that's the big lesson that Judah has learned. And it's in learning that lesson that next time we'll see that Joseph is now able to reconcile with his brothers because they are different people.